It is Wednesday, March the 12th, 2014. I am Steve Grohlick, the webmaster of www.gerweck.net. Grohlick.net is always your source on the World Wide Web for all your pro wrestling news going back to 1997. And we're going to travel back to 1997 with our guest today. We're going to talk about the Attitude Era, the Monday Night Wars, with a very successful wrestler from that period. He was in the Flock. He had a successful tag team with the American Males with Buff Bagwell. And today I welcome a very special guest to Gerweck.net, Scotty Riggs. How you doing today, Scotty?
Doing very good, man. And I'm actually glad you called me a wrestler.
Absolutely.
It seems like every interview I do, everyone ever talks about, here we have a superstar. I never wanted to be a superstar. Too many guys get into wrestling to be superstars. I always want to be a wrestler. I guess that's the athlete in me. You know, I always correct people and say, don't call me a superstar. I was a wrestler. You know, superstars make movies and all the other guys. I just want to be a wrestler. I got in the ring and competed.
Absolutely, and I appreciate that fact as well.
I appreciate you, you know, calling me a wrestler.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And we're going to talk a lot about wrestling on this interview because that's, I think we're both, you know, big fans of, you know, pro wrestling more than what they call sports entertainment today. And I think you had a very interesting career. But before we get into your career, can you update the fans what's going on with you and what you've been up to since retiring from the ring in 2009?
Pretty much just been, you know, enjoying retirement, I guess, to a point where it's just, you know, living on Inland Island. Was pretty much enjoying golf, enjoying some beach, doing some conventions. Just got back, actually, March 8th was in New York City. Did a big event in New York, number 6. We had Dennis Rodman was there, myself, Mark Bagwell, everyone from AJ Styles, Stevie Richards, Sharkboy, a lot of us were there. So I've been doing some conventions and stuff, just trying to hang out with the fans and enjoy being a fan instead of being one of the hated wrestlers like we used to be.
How much do you miss not being an active wrestler? How much do you miss, you know, being in the ring and performing?
Wow, I miss a lot, actually. I mean, the biggest thing that ended my career was I fractured the ulna bone, my left elbow, my left arm, where I had 13 screws and 2 steel plates put in there to fix it, and 3 surgeries, basically, where they flayed me like a fish, sliced open, with basically tore up the elbow, and there's no cartilage in there anymore, and I still have 5 screws that are in the joint holding the bun together and everything else. But, you know, when you've been involved in sports pretty much your whole life, I mean, I played football in grade school and high school and in college and basketball and all the other sports you can play, and went straight out of college, straight into wrestling. When your whole life is pretty much evolved around being active and being involved in a competition, you know, when the last thing you're doing is in the ring, you want that part to continue. You know, I could deal without the politics and all the other guy that went with it, but getting in the ring and performing for the fans and really trying to make them believe that what I'm doing is a competition, that's where you take a lot of great pride. And that's the one thing I miss, is being able to have those people in the palm of your hands going, well, we've got to hate him or we got to love him or however, you know, you're expected to be. That's the biggest thing you miss. I'll miss the bumps and bruises, but I do miss the actual seeming like a competition.
We'll talk a little bit about injuries, because I know you did a tweet that, you know, you went over kind of the history of your injuries, and how are you doing today physically? How is it tough to get up in the morning, or how are you feeling these days?
Every day is a new adventure when it comes to either trying to get up or get out of bed, roll out of bed, however you want to get it. The last series of MRIs I got, to make a long story short, my doctor said I have a neck and spine of an 85-year-old person. I just turned 48. I have two discs in my neck that are bad, one in my thoracic area, 3 in my lower back, had bone spurs all throughout my spine. Like I said, my elbows messed up, my shoulder joints are a little screwy. My whole body is pretty much cattywampus from torn muscles and Every other little thing. I'm not, no pretty party here, and I'm not trying to, cry me a river or anything. But it's just a lot of it came from football, also, and everything else that was involved in sports. But it's something that every little scar I have. When I was in New York this past week, I was showing one of the guys a scar on my elbow, and where I had the surgery, and I said, "Yeah, that scar is from, tripping over a cable and hitting the floor with my arm during a show." And, then I pointed to a scar on my right arm, my right forearm. I said, "Yeah, that's from where I went through a table wrestling Public Enemy." And this bump on my nose is from the third time that Rob Van Dam broke my nose. So every little injury, every little scar, every little bump and whatever is in your body, all has a story to go along with it, a tale. And so that way they're meaningful to me. That may sound a little psychotic or a little weird, but, my injuries tell me that I've lived life. I just didn't, go through it. So it's good being, feeling the age a little bit.
I tell you, one thing you've worked is, I know I was looking at a source and it said you were 43 years old. So I think you've done a good job working your working the internet on your real age.
Well, the funny thing I always told people is Riggs was 43, Scotty
okay.
was 48.
Gotcha.
You always got every wrestler somehow mixes and mingles. The internet is never always true what they say anyway. I remember my Wikipedia page said I was trained by Ted Arcini, and I never even met the man. I saw him wrestle back in the 80s, I think, in WWF. That Iron Man, the little short squad to do, but Ted Allen, the Nightmare, was the one who actually trained me.
And that was my next question.
Somebody actually corrected that for me.
Well, that's good. I'm looking at it now. It does say Ted Allen. I was wondering, can you just talk about a little bit, training with him and then, working independence in Georgia before you started with WCW?
The greatest thing about training with Ted was very old school. I actually met him in, I guess it was 91, the latter part of 91. A bunch of us went to, I went to West Georgia College. Got a degree in business management, played football there. And a lot of football players, I knew I was a wrestling fan. I had posters of the World Glories on my wall. They were like my psych-up thing. I'd always see their war paint and stuff and get ready to go in the field, but I always had their posters on the wall. And we actually went to a show, and an ice storm had hit that night, so the show got canceled. But I actually had a chance to meet some of the wrestlers, and I was 6'1", about 215-pound kid. 21, 22 years old when I met him and just started talking to him, and he asked me about training. And I actually worked with him for about 6 weeks, and he basically taught me how to run the ropes, how to lock up, how to take an arm, how to do a few basic things, how to land properly. And the next thing you know, 6 weeks later, he had me in the ring, wrestling my first match. And he basically taught me in the ring how to read a crowd, what moves to do, how to put moves together. Everything he taught me was old school, was in the ring in front of a crowd. And that's how you gained your experience. I mean, he taught Art Anderson, Big Boss Man, Ranger Ross, Tracy Smothers. He helped train referee Randy Anderson. So he had a lot of, influence in a lot of young guys' lives, became pretty good stars. Pretty good, major league players in the wrestling sport, and it was just really, he would get me in the ring and tell me nothing, and I don't know, I wouldn't even know what the finish was. He wore a mask, so he from communicate to me, so we would lock up, and he would just start talking, and I would just do nothing but listen, and he would teach me. We'd do 30-minute matches sometimes in some independent shows that he would have us booked on. I would go there early with him. I'd help set up the ring, and I'd take it down afterwards, and we'd be like maybe the second or third match on the show, and it would just be a way to get in the ring, and he would it would be a training session. I would actually get, paid $50, whatever it was, to get, to basically get trained. And to me, that was, there's no value you can put on that, really, because that carries on, that you can use that for the rest of your career, which you earn early. You know, you're able to improvise. You're able to, because if something's not working with the fans, something you might have planned or scheduled in your match, if it's not working, you can, you know, if you have plan B or plan C in your mind, you can go to it. A lot of the guys nowadays just do their matches, do their moves, and get the reactions from the crowd. And if it's not getting over, they keep going with it anyway. You know, because all they're worried about is being a TV show now. So that's kind of where the business has changed a little bit, where the sport has changed. Back then, you always worried about, you know, trying to get that reaction from the crowd. If you're getting the reaction from the real crowd, there you're getting the same reaction from the people at home. So, I mean, that was one of the things that Ted always taught me was, you know, if you're getting that reaction, real heartfelt reaction from the people that are there in the audience, anybody that's watching you at home, you're getting the same reaction out of them.
Now, you went to WCW in 1995. You only were in the business a few years. Do you feel like you were ready kind of for the big time at that point?
I actually started working with WCW back in 94. Maybe it's actually late 93, early 94. I had moved to Marietta, Georgia, and was still doing shows with Ted around and everything, and worked with some other promoters around the Southeast, and I got enough to actually work for IWCCW for the Savolis. Manny Fernandez got me on a couple of shows up there, and was just branching out, trying to, you know, wrestle other people and learn other stuff, learn other ways. And I moved to Marietta, and a friend of mine had a wrestling ring in the back of his karate school. And I'd actually started training at Man Event Fitness, which is Alexis Sting's gym, and a lot of wrestlers worked out there. And I actually became friends with Diamond Dallas Page, Steve Regal, Brad Armstrong, and they were all going down to the power plant, which was in Jonesboro, which is on the south side of Atlanta, about a 45-minute to an hour drive away from Marietta. I told them about the ring in the karate school, and they decided to come over and try and see what was going on. And ended up training with those guys. I mean, we were training with Brad Armstrong, who was, I mean, he was like water. He flowed so naturally. William Regal, who was so technically gifted. Paige, he was so creative in everything he did. And then he had Jake the Snake come in. And Jake helped with all this with psychology. And it was really, really, I mean, I was getting like a master's degree. Only being a year and a half in the business, in the sport of it all. And me and Paige put a match together and went down to the power plant to show it to Jody Hamilton, who was running the school. Paige wanted to show off a few things to Jody, who was helping train, you know, Paige also. So we go and do the match. Jody grabs me and says, "Who are you?" And I tell him who I am, Sky. And Paige interrupts and goes, "Jody, guess how long this kid's been working?" And he's like, "What, about 5-6 years? And he goes, "A year and a half." And Jody just, his jaw drops. And Jody goes, "You want a job on doing some TV?" I was like, "Sure, you know what I mean?" He goes, "I can guarantee you $200. He goes, "Plus, I'm in charge of TV matches. I can put you in good matches where people can maybe get a chance to notice you. Because you got some talent. You look good." And so, basically, I started doing some, you know, just some TV management work. And it's also got me basically on some house shows. I'd be like, open a match on house shows and do your open a match, 10-minute Broadway, your 10-minute draw, whatever, you know, you just kind of go out there and warm up the crowd a little bit, be your curtain jerker and just gain your experience. And I also work dark matches where they would actually get me some slip over wins on guys with like small packages and schoolboys and stuff like that. Just as a young kid, get the crowd to pop a little bit. And one of the first matches that Jody put me in that got me noticed was a match with stunning Steve Austin, Mr. Four Stone Cold. And it was supposed to be Sam Houston in the match, but I got put in there. And then Sam was going to show up, and then Sam wasn't going to show up. So I got put in, put out. And here's Austin is jerking my thing going, "Hey, kid, can you work the head? Okay, kid, we're going to work a head lock, you know, da, da, da. Hey, kid, let me change that. Can you work the arm?" And so he went head, arm, leg, back. You know, he was just yanking my chain the whole time. we go out there and end up doing it was an 8-minute match, which is about a good 6 minutes of ring time, of actual ring, you know, in-ring work, in 6.5. And with Nick Patrick as referee, and Dusty was the booker. And all I remember is Steve made me look like I was a 10-year veteran. Really didn't eat me up. We had a great competitive match. He caught me with his stun gun finish out of nowhere, 1, 2, 3. He sold that it was a competitive match. He just didn't pop up. Made everything look great. I'm sitting there blowed up, sky high. Nick Patrick is leaning over me going, kid, that was a hell of a match. Hell of a match, kid, da 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 da. I get to the back, and the first person to meet me is Dusty Rhodes. And Dusty was like, kid, I knew the finish. And we're sitting in the back watching on the monitor. We didn't know if you were going to win or lose. He goes, that was great. And then the next match I had was with Steve Regal, who had trained with. So Steve knew me. Had like a 7-minute match with Steve. And these matches slowly started getting me over with the booker, with Kevin Sullivan and Dusty and R and those guys who were in charge. And that was about the time that Bischoff was slowly starting to gain some control. And Arn Anderson actually gave me the best advice I ever had in my career at the time. And this is, I'm only maybe 2 years in the business, 2.5 years tops by the time. He told me I needed to get out of WCW for everyone to make it in the business. And, you know, in wrestling at all. And I was like, we need to get out. He pulled me aside at center stage one day. And he goes, you got a great look. You got a great ability. You're not argumentative. You want to work. You know, you got everything in the world, you know, is going for you. Great attitude. He goes, but Bischoff can't really take control. If you don't get out of here now, you're going to be stuck under a glass ceiling and you're never going to get a chance to grow. You're going to be viewed one way. So that actually got me out of WCW. Actually, Jake Snake Roberts introduced me to Jerry Lawler. And Jerry Lawler brought me into USWA at the beginning of 95. But I spent 8 months wrestling 6 nights a week for USWA from January 15th to about August 15th. I guess we were about the second, third week of August. 6 nights a week, it was unbelievable, the experience and the exposure I gained in USWA at the time. And that's what pretty much prepared me for my chance with Bagwell in 95 to come back to WCW.
Who came up with the Scotty Riggs ring name? And when you first started teaming up with Buff Bagwell, Marcus Alexander Bagwell, did you know him at all? And what was your first kind of reaction when they said, hey, we want to put you guys together as a tag team?
Well, we pretty much had met, you know, around Atlanta, so I'm at the gym. We were never buddies, we were never pals, but, you know, it was just one of those things where, like, you know, guys, you see each other. I was seeing at center stage doing the TV tapings, we'd say hello. He'd be in his own little world doing his own thing, which, you know, most of the guys were anyway. But we pretty much were getting along well, and when they put us together, we were sitting in Orlando at the at Universal, I think it was in this room, it was Lex, Stinger, Bagwell, I think the Nashies were in there, myself, and I think Alex Wright might have been. We were all kind of dressed in the same little room. And they came in, and Dave Penzer, who's the ring announcer, was going, okay, we got Bagwell, and are you going to, you know, I was asking about Scott Studd, which is what Ted Allen gave me to use. He goes, you're a stud, you know, we'll call you Scott Studd when you're wrestling. You're a young. You know, I started off as a bad guy, so I went by Stud. And Penzer goes, you want to use, you know, you want to use Scott Stud for your name? I was like, no, don't. And Randy Anderson, who was referee, Pee-wee, he goes, well, I'll use it. That's whoever knows you as. I'm like, well, you got Bagwell, who's a real name, and you got Stud, which is kind of like a gimmick name, like Dreamer or, you know, Sandman, you know, when it's a descriptive name. I said, I want to, you know, something that's a real name. And my favorite movie actor, or my favorite movie, Lethal Weapon, Martin Riggs, you know, well, Mel Gibson. So we came up with Riggs. I said, Riggs and Bagwell, Bagwell and Riggs. Flows well, sounds tough, let's go with it. That's what we went with Bagwell and Riggs. That's kind of how the name came up. And Stinger was like, yeah, that works good. You know, you look like a Riggs. So it flowed.
What was your thought when Bagwell went into the NWO and he kind of got the push and you didn't? How did you feel about that?
I mean, that was one of those times where, I mean, I was very happy for Marcus because the year and a half we'd spent together traveling and everything, I kind of seen how he had his ups and downs in tag teams. When he was with Scorpio, they used Scorpio's music, he had anti-Scorpio. When he was the Patriots partner, you know, came out with White and Blue, used Patriots music. Everything he kind of played second fiddle to. When we had the American Males, it was the first time that, you know, even he was excited to the American Males music, to the song, because it was finally something that, you know, was separate from everybody else and kind of identified us. It was our thing. It wasn't somebody else that he latched on to. And so basically, when he was approached, Kevin Nash came up to him and said, you know, we want to, you know, have you go end up here tonight. You be the first one to jump. He was actually supposed to put work with Steve Regal and put Regal over and was a little ticked off by having to do that. And Nash said, no, you're not doing that. We're going to turn you tonight. And have you joined? And that was actually, we talked about it. I said, man, this can be your chance to actually get something to go for you. You know, you've been stuck as a tag team babyface for so long. This can give you a breath of fresh air. And at the time, a lot of us still were, you know, we were working for the benefit of each other. We still had that team kind of concept. And for a year and a half, almost 2 years, Lex, Sting, Marcus, and myself have been traveling together. And so, we worked out together. We traveled together. We played golf together. We partied together. We, you know, would have dinners at each other's houses and hang out and stuff as regular friends would. And so, to me, this was a good chance to see him in business get a chance he'd never had before. So I was actually pretty supportive of it. Plus, it put me into a feud in a sense that automatically elevated me also. I didn't get the same rub as he got, but I got just enough to elevate me as a individual guy myself having a feud against him. I knew I'd be putting him over, but it still got me on pay-per-view. It got me a win on Nitros, got me a win on Clash of Champions. And the weirdest thing was that through a little bit of a monkey wrench and the whole thing was we wrestled each other as a sold-out pay-per-view in Cedar Rapids. Very next day, Norton, Jericho, Bagwell, myself go to Japan for 3 weeks. And we had to wrestle as the American Males over there for about the first 7-8 days of a 3-week tour, 20-day tour. And that's what kind of brought us over as. And then the news finally reached Japan that Bagwell had changed to NWO. But he had to change, so they pretty much split us up. Ended up tagging us down the rest over there with either Jericho. Or the only thing in Japan was you might wrestle one guy one night and you'd be tagging him with the next night. It was all competition-based. But what happened was we did a 3-week tour over there, and when we got back, we had like 1 week to set up a match for the next pay-per-view, which was the Uncensored pay-per-view. And we set that up at the our spring break Nitro, where I was wrestling Jericho, and Bagwell came out of nowhere and just started whipping me with a belt. So all of a sudden, we got a leather strap match. You know, it was really hokey how fast and how things they set it up. And so, bam, we got thrown in that match. And then pretty much right after that match is when it all just ended. And Marcus was trying to be buff, and instead of him getting his very good rub as a singles competitor, he went straight into a tag team with Scott Norton. So it's kind of disappointing to see, for me at least, I wouldn't see him do well singles for a change, but they automatically put him in there with Norton so he could be teaming with Norton over in Japan also as Vicious and Delicious. So I just kind of came back and said, well, man, to me it was a little, you know, just disappointing that he didn't really push to get that singles run like he should have had.
Yeah, well, you were disappointed. I mean, they went with Buff in the NWO, which was the big angle at the time, the invasion, the story that, you know, they were taking over WCW, so they were front and center in the storylines. Were you disappointed at all they didn't ask you maybe to be a part of the NWO?
Actually, I didn't want to be, because I saw who was in the NWO, the main players, and I knew, even when Marcus kind of joined it, I knew he wasn't going to get the big look those guys had. They got him in it, and that was going to be the biggest extent of the rub he got. I just knew how those guys were, and I would rather do my own thing than be a part of their thing, if that makes any sense. Just because they have their own agendas. And right. You might be a part of what they're doing, but you're not going to be what they're doing. And so I was glad I didn't be a part of it. I wanted to be against it. Because, again, if I would have just joined like everybody else did, I would have got lost in the shuffle. But being against it, it brought me a little more to the forefront. Even though it wasn't a lasting part of it, it was still, I was still part of Team WCW at the first NWO sold out, So that kind of elevated me in the fan lives. I was part of that team.
What was it like going from being the pretty boy into the grungy gimmick and joining the flock? How different was it to approach that type of character?
That was a blast. that was more fun than I even thought I could have. It was very easy to be in that grunge gimmick, I guess, with the flock and everything else. The hardest part was having to wear that eye patch all the time, because I was legitimately blind in the eye, because I wore an opaque contact lens. When I got hit with a chair, it did bruise my eye, and so the bright lights of the TV would give me headaches. So I had to put an opaque contact lens in to protect the eye from the bright lights and wear the eye patch. So I was legitimately 100% blind in that eye. And my depth perception was way off, but in being part of that grunge thing, that was what was, I was trying to say it was popular at the time, but it was something that the fans would gravitate to hating. They really did. They hated the flock. And the fact that we sat with the crowd and had our seats, that was something cool that nobody else did. We had that going for us, got that little deal started. And so when the whole flock was out there, you wouldn't believe the dog cussing we would get from kids, from teenagers, from parents, from, girl, everything. Everyone would be screaming at us, throwing stuff at us. We would get just, raped and pillaged basically by the crowd verbally all during the show. And then we'd jump on a Benoit, we'd jump on Paige or Jannetty or Booker or somebody, beat them up to, set up what we're doing for the next couple of weeks on Nitro or the Thunder or the Saturday Night or whatever. And we would get even, we actually got in a fight in the crowd. It was the Nitro where me and Saturn wrestled McMichaels and Benoit. It was at Georgia Dome. It was when Hogan and Russell Goldberg. We actually were leading back up through the crowd. And Georgia Dome, big, huge building. We had to go up these stairs, around the corner, and down to an elevator to take us down to the dressing room. And when we went up going up the stairs, these guys started throwing punches at us. So we actually had to throw legit punches back at guys to fight our way back up through the crowd to get to the elevators. We only had like a security guy in front of us and nobody was behind us. It's kind of a fail on security's part and not protecting our own selves' fault. We maybe could have slid out of sight and gone another way, but we ended up going back up to the crowd like we came in. And boy, that was a fight. But to one sense it was good, and that means people really hated us. We had legit heat. And that actually worked great for us for the wrestling crowd, but works against us in the politics and the dressing room, I guess. Because it wasn't pretty much sure after that they ended up wanting to split us up. Because we had real heat when the NWO didn't have any. They were going to be the cool heels, and we were stealing their thunder. They didn't like that.
No pun intended with thunder there.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, you caught me on that one, didn't you?
I got a question from Twitter here. It says, I heard an interview where Raven said he didn't really want you in the flock in the beginning, But when you did the eye patch, he thought you got over. Did you ever sense that Raven didn't really want you a part of the group?
We had talked about it, and what Raven was really wanting to kind of do with me was kind of make me his Tommy Dreamer and kind of have a feud with me where we go back and forth for a while. And, you know, then when the eye injury came about and the eye patch came in, Raven saw, you know, a persona, a gimmick that actually fit perfectly into, you know, what the Flock was, a bunch of rejects, a bunch of, you know, nobody wanted us, you know, we were drags to society. You know, we had Kidman, you know, be from, you know, Spandex Billy is what he called them, you know. Had him turn into the heroin addict where you sit there ringside scratching himself. You know, right. So heroin addicts do, they scratch. They itch all the time because they're getting other Joneses off of heroin. He had Ben Hammer come back as this big, tall, Marilyn Manson looking guy. Saturn came in just being Saturn. Lodi came in as a guy out of the power plant that nobody knew, Red Billy Idol. Sick Boy came out of the power plant, nobody knew, and he just fit the Sick Boy name. That's what Raven gave him. And when I came in, I was the only one who actually, in a sense, fought his way into being a part of the Flock. Everybody else just kind of showed up. I was the one who got beat up and got kidnapped and everything else to become part of it. So at first, Raven wanted to kind of have a feud with me to establish himself, to help build me up a little bit and me kind of be his Tommy Dreamer. But it worked out better that I ended up joining the group and using the patch gimmick and just changing my entire look.
Did Raven have creative control of the group? Could he kind of decide who was in and who was out of his group?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he brought in Reese. The same thing kind of happened with the Flock that kind of happened with NWO. We brought in almost too many guys. If it would have been kept the original group of maybe like, you know, Steve Richard had left, and if it maybe would have just been Kidman and Saturn, Sick Boy, Hammer, and myself, but then he brought in Reese because you want to bring in the real big monster misfit. And then Horace Hogan came in because, he, you know, Raven was kind of playing a little politics and goes, bring in Hogan's nephew. Maybe, you know, if we do something with him and give him a nice little rub, maybe Hogan will, you know, play a little politics with us and keep the Flock over strong. Well, do we know that that didn't last very long, and next we know Horace was part of the Black and White at the NWO. So that really didn't pan out too well politically. But, yeah, pretty much when it came to the say-so of who was going to be in it and how we kind of wanted things to go, Raven had that influence. He did have a lot more pull than people thought he had in the back, especially with what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it.
What happened at the end of your WCW tenure? You know, you were part of the Flock, and then they broke you off, and you went singles for a while, and then it seemed like within a short time you were gone. What happened, and how did they explain your departure from the company? I mean, what did they say?
Well, I mean,
they...
pretty much, when they decided they were going to split the Flock up, I had actually approached Jerry Taylor and some of the booking committee guys and the other guys and said, you know, I want to keep the eye patch and keep the look and kind of be, kind of patted myself up to like Snake Plissken, the Kurt Russell character from Escape from New York and Escape from L.A., had the eye patch, you know, and just kind of looked like he had. And the first thing Terry Taylor said was, no, you're not doing that. We're going to completely change you back to being, you know, we want you to be a pretty boy again. But we'll keep you being a bad guy, but we want you to, you know, to be, a, you know, kind of, you know, the narcissist type guy, which is why I didn't break out the mirror. That was kind of their idea. They wanted me to change back over to be almost an American Male thing again, which kind of was, it almost was a kiss of death for me, because to go from one look to one thing and then you're back to the other, and it's just like, I wasn't feeling it, the fans weren't feeling it. If you notice toward the end of it, I wasn't even using the mirror anymore they wanted me to use. You know, they brought me out and kind of debuted the character at the Spring Stampede pay-per-view in 99 against Mikey Ripwreck. And I used the mirror for a short time after that, and then finally I just said, I wonder if you won't even notice me using the mirror anymore, because I didn't like it. And I just dished it, and the next thing you know, they didn't even notice. And so I was like, fine, I don't have to even worry about using the mirror anymore. And I had actually negotiated a deal with J.J. Dillon and I can't remember if Terry was the head booker at the time or it was Sullivan. But I had actually negotiated a deal with those guys to come in for a little bit more money for one more year. Because my 3-year deal had ended. I had signed a 1-year when I first came in, got another 1-year deal from Bischoff, and then a 3-year deal. And then in my 3-year deal, I negotiated another deal, and when I went in to sign it, they actually said they had to take that offer back and wanted to lower my money a bit because they're bringing in Jeff Jarrett, a few other guys that they wanted to bring in that were higher priced guys, and they had to free up some money in their accounting at the time because they had a lot of guys that, you know, were mid-card area that they were paying good money to. And they actually wanted to drop my money. And I didn't want to go for that. I said, well, this is one deal we negotiated. I'm not going to negotiate for a lesser paid deal and not know what's going on because Bischoff had been gone at the time for a short period of time. They put Bill Bush, who was an accountant, as the executive vice president of the company. The guy had no wrestling dealings at all. He was an accountant. Oh, he was telling everybody, well, you can do this with the money, you got to do that with the money for bringing this guy in. This guy, you know, he was just telling what we got to do with the money. He had no idea what was going on with the wrestling side of it. And so everything became a numbers game back then. They kept a lot of guys who were very, very low priced, a lot of guys who were very, very high priced. They were getting paid by Turner Home Entertainment. They were getting paid by TPS or WCW. They were getting paid by Warner Brothers. So, it was Warner Brothers, however that goes. But they didn't even have a TBS WCW contract. They had Turner Home Entertainment contract. So, as soon as I saw that kind of writing on the wall, I was kind of happy to, when they said, well, we're not going to renew your deal. I said, well, fine. As long as I don't have a 90-day complete clause, I'll be done when my contract is done. They said, fine. And actually, my last match, it ended December 31st of 99. And my last match was actually Chris Benoit at a Saturday Night TV taping, which was in November. So I actually got about a 6-week vacation, was sent home collecting some checks. We didn't have to go on the road, didn't do anything, just got paid by those. That's, in a sense, of how that they wasted money by not putting me to work. At least, having people beat me, which to me that their mindset was, well, if he's not re-signing, we're just paying to sit at home. And was just one of the stupid things they did. When I signed my first contract with WCW in 95, I was number 47, I believe it was, 47 or 48, I had a contract. When I left in 99, there was like 199 people that had contracts, all guaranteed contracts. So I know Lanny Poffo, Randy Savage's brother, had a 2-year contract where I think it was getting paid either 50 or 75 grand a year and never wrestled once.
Never appeared on TV.
They brought him to one show and he never wrestled once.
Wow.
See, Bischoff went and signed everybody in the world when they started doing the Nitro and the Thunder. He signed everybody and their mother to a contract. There was a few mother and they were Bagwell's mom. But they signed everybody and their mother to a contract to keep them from going to wrestle for Vince. And he only used, out of the couple hundred people he signed, he only used 50 of us on a regular basis. Thunder was supposed to be his own completely different show. But when the NWO guys all saw that Thunder was another live show, of course, they all wanted to be on Thunder now. So they had live Thunder on Monday, live Nitro on Monday, live Thunder on Tuesday or Thursday. They didn't want to be on Saturday night because that was the tape show. And then the other pay-per-views. So most of your top guys all wanted to be on the live shows. They didn't want anything to do with tape shows. Those were the underlings to be on tape shows. So that was how they were wasting money back then that really just made things negative at WCW at the time. So towards the end of my time there, it was, you know, you had too many people that had creative control on their contracts. It really made it hard to be around, to really be positive, to get in the ring and have great matches. Too many guys were looking out for themselves towards that end there.
I wonder, what is your overall opinion of Eric Bischoff? I think there's a lot of people that really like him. There's a lot of people who didn't like him. Your opinion of him from maybe a creative standpoint, of course, he gets a lot of the credit of the NWO angle. He gets a lot of blame for what happened, the demise of WCW. Talk about his management style. And I guess when you think of Bischoff, I mean, some people think he's like a Hall of Famer, that, you know, because of what he created with Nitro, that he should be in the WWF Hall of Fame or WWE Hall of Fame. Just kind of your where's his place in history?
The only time I saw Eric was when it had to do with my contract.
Okay.
Basically. I mean, I never had any of the dealings with him, except for when Bagwell turned on me. The only actual ring time I had with him was when Bagwell turned on me and dropped me in the ring. I'm in the ring with the Giant, Hall, Nash, Bischoff, Bagwell, X-Pac in there, and Bischoff starts kicking me. Well, he's nice little, easy little love tap kicks, but I'm actually sitting there going, "Oh, you stiff little bitch!" Oh, I'm actually screaming. I'm like, he's killing me, and he's going, "I ain't touching you." I'm saying, "You're killing me. You're killing me." You know, it's just my way of ribbing him in a sense. You know, that he, I was telling him he was killing me in those kicks, but he really wasn't even touching me. But the only time I ever saw him, like I said, when I got my first deal, that was done through Kevin Sullivan. Actually, that went for about three, four months, my first deal. And I got my first contract from Eric. And then that went for a year. And then my next contract that led to my three-year deal, I actually worked about 4 months without a contract. And could have easily gone to WWE at the time, WWF, whatever you want to call them, because what the scoop was going around was they were starting a light heavyweight division, kind of like compete with the cruiserweight division, and there was a dirt sheet internet rumor that I was going there to be one of the starters of the division for Vince. And Eric came up to me and said, "Hey, I heard you were working without a contract. I appreciate your loyalty. I want to offer you a three-year deal with this figure, this figure, this figure, each year getting a raise, and also make it to where you'll get your back pay. You'll start January 1st of this year, and you'll get everything, you know, you get one big paycheck for the past few months that, you know, you've been working on that old deal." And I said, "Well, can you make the last year for this amount?" And he goes, "Sure, we'll do that." And he goes, or we can make, you know, you can do each 1 year. I said, "Not really, that's the security of a three-year deal." And so I got a couple of perks thrown in there that we talked about, and that was just in catering. Otherwise, I never saw the guy. He was off doing his own thing with NWO. The only guys I really dealt with were either Dusty, Terry Taylor, or Kevin Sullivan, or Arn Anderson, who were all on the booking committee. The only real props I give Eric for is in the business sense and creating Nitro. I really don't know what legit thing he had in creating the NWO. I know in bringing in Hall and Nash and how they came up with New World Order and that, I really don't even know the whole story behind it because I wasn't in the meetings for it. But I just know that his brainchild was Nitro. His creativity came from what everybody else wanted to do in their creativity. And, you know, the ideas were Hall's, Nash's, Hogan's, Sting's, Luger's, Goldberg. They all had their creative part that he kind of took a little bit of credit for. And because a lot of the ideas were the wrestler's ideas that he allowed to be done. And then all he was worried about was the main card stuff. He didn't even worry about what was going on with the Flock and our program with Paige or our program with Benoit or anything like that. Everything we did with that was cleared through, like I said, Kevin Sullivan or Ernest and whoever the booking committee was. The funny thing was, it was different than I know in working for events, everything, whether you're the first match, the Divas, or whatever the finish is, whatever the ending's going to be, whatever the time is going to be, all is paired through Vince. Bischoff never did that. He was worried about the top stuff, and that was it, that he was involved in. Everything else he let his underlings take control of. And that was the funny thing. A lot of the undercard stuff was the most over-popular stuff that was going on. It was the most creative, most fan-friendly, most fans got into what was going on with it. A lot of the over stuff, the high-price stuff, the fans were, they were into, but really didn't get behind it as much. Doesn't make any sense to you. Kind of like we talked about before, we even started doing the interview, how the mid-card matches were better matches, were better storylines than your upper card stuff, because what Hogan did was a lot of, he rehashed every angle he did in the 80s, he did in the 90s. You know, when Nitro was live, he brought in all his old foes and wrestled them like he did in the 80s. And the fans weren't all that into that. They loved the mid-card stuff, like Eddie Guerrero versus Six. Some of their matches were the best matches I ever saw in my life. They were great stuff. Hogan, Guerrero, and Kidman had tremendous matches. Benoit and Paige were having great matches. But then you had Piper and Hogan, we did 20 years after their prime, didn't have the same impact. Had great name power, but not great impact. Savage and Paige had great impact, had great matches, but that still wasn't even seen as a main card thing until later. Hopefully that makes sense what I'm saying.
Yeah, I was thinking like Psychosis and Juventud Guerrero and the cruiserweight division, which I thought was one of the biggest parts of Nitro, and it was always usually one of the best matches on the show, and they would just be hyping up the big stuff, and a lot of times not even really paying attention to the cruiserweight match itself on Nitro.
Exactly.
That always was kind
of
frustrating.
Even when I'm sitting in the back sometimes, we'd be sitting there watching on the monitor, and you'd hear the commentary, and you're going, why can't they talk about the match? Well, you know, you got, you know, two great kids in there working their butts off, and great matches, great moves, great everything, you know, name any cruiserweight, like I said, Kim and Hogan, too. They'd be talking about Hogan, you know, trying to get a Goldberg later. Or they'd be talking about, you know, Bischoff saying that they would not talk about the matches. And that was, again, part of the downfall. Fans didn't like the fact that they were being dumbed into not appreciating what was being seen on TV. So one thing I give Vince a lot of credit for, it, most of the time, everything they talk about is what is going on in that match and the angles that those guys in that match have. Really, ever does he talk about what's going on later on in the show during the match? You know, you treat your fans like idiots when you do that. And that was unfortunately the stuff that was being fed into the ears of our announce team. You know, the one thing I appreciate that Bobby Heenan always did, if Heenan ever blasted you, if he ever put you down, if he ever talked bad about you during commentary, it's because he liked you. And he was trying to get you over. That was his job, was to bash you. If he didn't bash you, he didn't care about you. He used to dog me, but he used to love my eyelash gimmick. He really did. He used to tell me, he goes, man, that's one of the best things I've seen. He goes, you're working it right. There's a few more stumble things you could do along the way. He goes, but it's one of those incredible things we've done in a long time. He used to always say something about, you know, once you pull the eye patch over and put it on the good eye, you can't see a thing. You know, and he would talk with all people out. He'd do stuff, but that was what Bobby Heenan did to get you over. If he said something positive about you, the fans would be going, what is Heenan talking about? That's not Heenan. So he had to be his brash against you type personality, which is really cool. The other guys, they rambled away, it seemed like, too many times. It was instead, until it became the main matches, and then they tried to be on point because they were told to do.
We just recently interviewed Lodi, and he was talking about...
Good old Lodi.
Yeah, you get to Nitro, it's the afternoon, they put up a board, the board changes, the board disappears. you know, it's an half an hour before the Nitro is ready to go on the air, and nobody knows what's going on or who's working what. Can you just talk about the chaos that would go into a weekly situation in the Nitro?
On an interview did last night, same thing. Me and Maestro came on a show, the Stro, whatever I call it, Maestro in WCW. We were talking about it last night for a minute that, back then we would come in at 3 o'clock and it'd be a board up for 12 segments, 3 hours, live show, each match, who you're wrestling, when you're wrestling, who's got promos, blah, 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 blah. What tape promos you got to have and anything else. And when everybody's supposed to be there at three, you know, tape between two and three for catering, sit back, do what you got to do, and all that, get set up for the night. All the big picks are coming at five and say, no, I don't want to do this match. I want to promo here. I want to promo there. And they would take the whole board, erase everything, and it would be an hour, 7:30, right before we're going on air for 3 hours. And it would always start like it's 7:57. You know, we start 3 minutes early and then 7 minutes late because we have to get those rating points in. And why do you think it started off with Juventud versus Kidman, match number 7,163? They started off with a two-segment match because they're still putting the show together. You know, the other guys who had creative control in the contract didn't like what they were doing in the show, the bookers created. Then they would have them come in and change everything. And everybody would be told, get dressed. Don't know when you're going on. You may not know who you're wrestling, but we'll tell you before you go out there. And it would be utter chaos. It would be a cluster. I mean, you see guys, you know, say, you know, wrestler, you know, say Booker versus Bagwell. Booker's got, you know, is beating Bagwell. Bagwell doesn't like getting beat, so he goes in and bitches. And they come out and say, okay, and they just change. Okay, back where you're going over. Then Booker goes in the bitches. Then they go, okay, we're going back to the original finish. And that's how it would be. You know, I'm just throwing those names out, not to happen, but just, you know, that's how it would be. It would be two people arguing right before they're going out there who's going over because nothing was said up beforehand. Nothing you could communicate all day about and figure out the right way to do things. Everything was done off the cuff with utter confusion. And when you have that going on, that's not a recipe for success. You know, controversy may create cash, but confusion creates dismemberment. You know, because basically we were cutting each other off left and right. Wow, I just created a new book title.
As I was saying, you were with WCW. At the end of 99 when your contract expired, and WCW was only in business about 15 months after that. Were you surprised what happened with WCW at the end? Were you surprised that it ended up with Vince McMahon, you know, purchasing the company? Or how did you ultimately see WCW going over the years?
Well, I mean, the only thing that surprised is when I left there and went to ECW, I mean, I already saw everybody walked on eggshells. Nobody knew who was going to be having a job. I mean, they had the highest price of guys still around, and then they had the lowest price of guys they could find from another school, a bunch of young talent that just were getting shoved in the spots that they weren't ready for. And it was just, there was nothing that was cohesive about it. I ended up being very blessed and going to ECW, even though it had its own financial demise. But the attitude of the locker room was what's best for, you know, the match. You know, there were egos, but no egos. And like, I'm going to cut your throat and stab you in the back type ego. Well, WCW, everyone's fighting for whatever scrap they could get to still be on TV. Didn't matter who they stepped on, they wanted to be up on TV while they could. And it just turned, when Vince Russo came in, one of the first things he said, he was going to kind of spike the ratings, he was going to spike this, he was going to do that, he was going to be a writer. And the next thing you know, when the guy who's supposed to be the head writer, that's his job, is all of a sudden the main character on TV, I knew something was really, really wrong. And when he wears the championship, when he puts the towel on himself, something's really, really wrong. When the writer of the show is putting himself as the main character, that place is going downhill.
Yep.
And that's what happened. You know, everybody can claim whatever they want, but it's the outside view. After being there for so long, with the outside view, I just saw how everyone played a supportive role to the head writer being the head character. Well, like in ECW, Paul Heyman might have been he was a head writer along with Tommy Dreamer and along with, you know, Raven and C.W. Anderson and Carino and Van Damme and those guys all had the creative juices in what was going on. But Paul didn't make himself the main character. Each person had their role to play, and he let them play their role. And he gave them the spotlight each time. That wasn't happening in WCW anymore. Everyone was, you could just see the struggle that was going on when you watched the show. You could see there was no fluidity in what was going on. And, I mean, I hated to see it go because it was something that I grew up watching. It was something that I was proud to be a part of when I first joined it. But, man, when it ended, it definitely was not the same company that I started to work for. And that's a shame about it. It went from being such a great avenue, such a great place to watch guys grow, become wrestlers. Even if they started there and went to Vince, you saw Brian Pillman grow into a big star. Working for Vince, you saw Steve Austin grow. And even though it seemed like a feeder system in a sense for Vince, it still was something that a lot of great talent grew up in. Diamond Dallas Page grew up there and became a huge, you know, a big-time wrestler in that era. Christopher Maul became a huge wrestler then, and then became even bigger for Vince. But it all had that gusto to it until. And then when the spotlight seemed to be off the wrestlers, it seemed to be on more on the girls and the head writer, you know, it just became, you know, became a show of itself, and, you know, it just kind of was ashamed to be, you know, a part of it. I was glad I wasn't even there, to be honest with you.
Looking back at your WCW tenure, what was the highlight and what would you consider the low light of your experience there?
Wow. I mean, I'll be honest. The highlight was the friendships I created with, you know, it wasn't ever portrayed on TV, but I was really great friends with Sting, Lex, and Marcus. Like I said before, we played golf together. We built great friendships. I can still call those guys, talk to those guys today, text them, talk to them, wish each other happy birthday and everything. And I grew some great friendships as a highlight there. Maybe as a wrestling side of it, I'd say the Flock to me was a highlight of it. Even, you know, saying I went after World Tag Team Champions, but the Flock was so much more fun because you really felt the heat, the anger, the hatred the fans had for you when we were sitting in there, because we were so unique and sitting in the crowd and starting our matches off from being in the audience and everything else. And that separated us so much more than, you know, anything I did beforehand there. So that was really, really, to me, wrestling-wise, was a pinnacle for me. Because that was just something I was so not, what's the right word I'm looking for here? That was so out of character, because everything that I've always done before and even after, they always probably wanted me to be a pretty boy. You know, be the good-looking guy, to be the handsome thing. This allowed me to be, you know, wear the eye patch and the hair down the face and the grunge and not worry about being the pretty boy. And that was so much more fun, and the people actually got into that more. They saw that side of me where I didn't have to always portray the same thing. And when they saw me really delving into something that was the inner side of me, they dug it. The fans got into it, and so did I. And I guess probably the low light was having to use that mirror for a short period of time. Some people liked it, and we tried to make the most of it. It's like the camera guys would always have me standing in the corner. And the guy in the corner camera would get on the little box and shoot into the mirror, and you'd see my reflection in the mirror. And I would talk to the mirror, and it looked like I was talking to the camera through the mirror. And that was something the camera guys came up with to try to spice it up for me. You got camera guys trying to spice up your character for you. Not the creative guys, not the bookers, not the owner, not Bischoff, not the guys running the thing, but your camera guys are trying to help you spice up your character. That's how goofy that place was. It was cool. It was cool they did that for me. And when we shot videotape of all kinds of stuff, kind of like Cody Rhodes did with all the mirrors and stuff, you know, in dressing rooms and hotel places, we shot hours and hours of vignettes that were never, ever used. And they spent $80,000 on me and Marcus with the black and white American Males video we did, which was like a minute and 3 seconds. They spent $80,000 in 3 days of us shooting all in Atlanta to put that thing together. And they only used it for a couple weeks. They never used it again. And then NWO were the only ones that could do black and white. So it's kind of like, okay, you know, we couldn't even use our own video. They spent $80,000 on it. NWO was black and white. We couldn't do it. So it really became a wacky time in WCW where we had your highest of highs, definitely a lowest of lows.
At the end of ECW, I mean, basically you were there only a short time because the company folded. How much money were you owed, and did you ever see a dime of it?
I was owed a good chunk of change. I mean, there's no need to dredge up a figure for you now. And the only way I ever put it is I have about a five-figure CD with the crap song on it. It was the only payday I got out of it.
Wow.
Because when it went out, pretty much only a handful of people actually got something. And that was about it. I mean, it was a very, very few handful of people that got something. I actually don't know how they got it. I know a few guys that have been there since day one with the company and never saw what they were supposed to get paid. And even after it closed down, they were promised they would get paid something they never did. And these are guys that were, you know, longtime veterans with Paul and with the company. So, you know, I was there pretty much for a good 6 to 8 months. The last few months that was before they closed down, I actually had cracked my ribs in a match of Van Damme at the Hammerstein Ballroom. It was out for about 6 to 8 weeks. In the last 6 to 8 weeks, I was out with an injury. It was the time that they were actually, you know, going into where they were folding. And Van Damme stopped coming to work. You know, he wouldn't, you know, because he knew he wasn't getting paid, so he wasn't going to show up. So other guys stopped showing up. And actually, I think for the last pay-per-view, Rob came in, I think, to work Jerry Lynn or something. I can't remember how it went. But they had to pay Rob pretty much, I think, three-fourths of what they owed him the minute he got there from where she worked at pay-per-view. And so that's all some of the guys who were at pay-per-view, they worked it, knowing they were going to get their last pay. It wasn't going to mean a check. They were going to get their last pay that day. So that's why a lot of the guys that came in that last pay-per-view and worked it. And that was a shame, because that was a great place that men, another great place that Paul Lee was the first guy that ever came in and said, hey, he sat me down when I first started with him. Said, Sky, this is what we're going to do with you. We're going to make you do the crap thing, which basically we're going to be poking fun at what you and Marcus did with the American Males. He goes, you got great work ability. It's going to get you over with the fans and add something that can sink your teeth into it, a personality for you. And we're going to have you be Rob's best friend, Strava, and, you know, Rob wants you to turn against him, so we're going to have you turn. And he gave me about a six-month layout of what he wanted to do with me. And I guarantee you, it fell like dominoes. And that's how much of an evil genius that Paul Lee was when it came to wrestling. He was great at wrestling. And if you could put Paul Lee and probably Eric Bischoff together to run a company, Eric could do the business side of it. And get your TV show, get your, you know, on cable and connecting him for you and let Paul do the wrestling side of it, they probably run Vince out of business. Because one was a great wrestling mind, and the other was a great business mind. Heyman had a great, evil, genius Dr. Frankenstein wrestling mind when it came to that aspect of it. He sucked as a businessman. But on the flip side, Bischoff is great at getting Nitro on the air and dealing with executives and being a businessman. And he could, you know, he wouldn't deal with the best of them. When it came to the wrestling aspect, he left that to everybody else to make successful for him. That's where Kevin Sullivan and Arn Anderson and Dusty Rhodes, those guys came into play working for Bischoff. So put those two together, they could probably put Vince out of business. They'd be the only two that could.
Well, I think there certainly was a time when we thought maybe Nitro would put, you know, Vince out of business. I mean, they really, you know, looking back at the ratings, they were really dominating.
Well, it was
Vince.
Hot for a while until everything started getting watered down. When you go from the NWO and the heel faction they're supposed to be, and all of a sudden you got the NWO Black and White, which is basically their enhancement division. And then you have the NWO Wolfpack, which is their over guys. You know, and when you take the biggest part that you have that's supposed to be against WCW and always put into factions, you already know that you've gone too far with it. They watered it down with everybody in the world either joining it, leaving it, joining it, leaving it. And it just didn't have the same it didn't have the same sustenance like it had before. It wasn't the same meat and potatoes. It also became succotash. So,
absolutely.
It didn't have the same bite. You know, it was unfortunate because they had a great thing, but nobody that was in the main group wanted to be losing left or right or putting guys over or doing anything. So they had to create a second wave of guys. You know that. You know, some night, some, you know, somebody said that. How's it go? Some have to die so others may live. You know, that's why they created a second group of NWO guys. Those were the guys, the NWO guys that had to die. They had to lose so the other NWO guys could live. And it's, you know, that's the egotistical part of the business.
What was your thought when they brought in Bret Hart? How he was either utilized or underutilized in the company?
I think they totally misused him. He was one of the coolest guys in the world when he came in to me. I remember I was sitting at catering, and he walked up and basically introduced himself. Of course, he knew who he was. He introduced himself to me and sat down and talked to me for about 45 minutes, an hour, about some of my matches, knew my drop kick. I mean, he knew stuff about me. I wasn't the only person he did that with, but he took time to go around and introduce himself to everybody. He was a cosmic professional and really, really a great guy to be around and learn from. A lot of the other guys that came in, I won't really mention names, but they came in and looked down upon you and they all gave you the old, you know, and walked past you. And that was about all you got from them when they went into their private dressing room. Bret Hart, Kurt Hennig, Rick Rude, those guys, they trusted everybody. You know, the same dressing room. You know, we all shared one big dressing room. Savage, those guys, we all shared the same big dressing room. Everyone dressed the same place. Some of the guys had their own private dressing rooms. And we weren't allowed to go in there. They had their own catering, their whole nine yards. And that was when part of the separation of church and state cards started happening. But Bret never seemed to be... He never seemed to play on either side. He was just wasn't going to do his thing, have great matches, but they just never seemed to use him right. He came off a hot thing going on with the Montreal Screwjob. They could have done some incredible stuff with him. And it just seemed that they wanted him to just be a bit player instead of a mainstay. And that was, you know, if you didn't fit into somebody else's plans for you, you didn't fit into anybody's plans. And I don't know why they didn't do anything better with him. It's a shame.
Absolutely, especially when he was so hot after the Montreal angle.
Well, he was
never
huge. He was bigger than life, and that was probably what the problem was.
I thought nothing
coming
bring
in
him
being
to
huge, and some of the guys that were there, they were finally being huge in their own right for a change in their own minds. They didn't want him to steal their thunder. And that was the one problem out there. WCW had everyone had their own little group of we're out for ourselves. We're out for these four guys. We're out for this guy. I'm out for my, you know, nobody was out for the team. You know, nobody wanted to put on a one big great show. It was everybody wanted to have their own private island of me on high and you down low. And, you know, when you had that kind of cancer, it kills.
Yep. I have to ask you this because you worked with a guy. Your reaction to how did you find out about the Chris Benoit situation and your reaction? Because obviously you worked with the guy, you knew him pretty well. Your overall thoughts, was it a major surprise to you? I know some people said they saw a darker side of Chris Benoit. What was going through your mind when you heard about that story?
I mean, to be honest with you, I'd never seen a dark side. I'm sure everyone has a dark side. But I'd never seen a dark side of Chris. You know, every time I saw Chris, Nancy, and Daniel, very loving family, Nancy was always a sweetheart to me. I played around with Daniel here and there, and, you know, I'd eaten dinner with them before, and to me, they were just a great loving family. I'm sure, you know, everyone has their arguments. Everyone has their back and forth, whatever happens. But I remember I was at my condo in Hilton Head when I got a text message. It was from Daphne, and she told me that the whole Benoit family had died, but she had no details. I was like, "What?" You know, I'm getting a text message, not a verbal thing, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I just started bawling my eyes out from the start. I didn't know what happened. I had to get on the internet to find out what was going on, and there were no details and nothing that was going on about it. But even when all the details came out, you know, I was really shocked over what was being said and what was being done and how everything was being portrayed when nobody really knew the answers. Everyone blamed it on either steroids or drugs or this. And then when it came out that there were, you know, the concussion problems, the CTE problems, everyone blew them off and said, no, it had to be the drugs, it had to be the steroids. You know, and there's no definitive answer. I don't think the only person that really knows what happened are Chris, Nancy, and Daniel. You know, no one else knows what really happened. And the way I still view it and the way I think about it is whatever happened, it wasn't the Chris, Nancy, and Daniel that I knew that passed away that weekend. It was another form. It might have been the body, but it wasn't the spirit. It wasn't the heart. You know, it might have been the flesh of Chris, of how things happened, but it wasn't the person that I knew. And you know, that's the saving grace I have with the whole mentality of it is, you know, I know he just didn't turn into a monster overnight or in a couple of days and just do that. You know, it just didn't boom, snap, and it happened. Who knows really what was going on in his mind? I knew guys who told me that he'd been having problems, you know, real just delusional what was going on around him. Was real fearful for himself or his family with, you know, no concrete reason of being that. But that's kind of what was going on with him. He would take different routes to the airport thinking he was being followed. He would, you know, just different things he was doing that didn't have any rhyme or reason to him. And again, maybe the medical tests that were done maybe could show why with the CTE, with the concussion problems that he had. I mean, Vern Gagne was 80-something years old when he was in a nursing home. Snapped and killed, I think it was a roommate or another person in the, I don't know if you know the story, but he killed another guy in the nursing home.
Yep, they said it was the story.
Dementia, and it was, you know, from, you know, it was his brain that did it. And he was not convicted of murder. Everybody else was going to go ahead and convict a 40-year-old Chris for murder, for being his monster, for being evil, and everything else, when it could have just been the same thing. His mind is messing with him. And I saw a thing on Outside the Lines on concussions. They were interviewing Jim McMahon, the quarterback. And McMahon said, when your mind starts messing with you, there's not a whole lot you can do. You know what I mean? When your own mind starts messing with you, there's not a whole lot of answers. You know, you either got to fight it one way or you're going to succumb to it. But it's your own self messing with yourself. How do you battle that?
Right.
There's really no
answer. I understand that you're going to donate your brain after you pass?
Yes, yes.
For science?
I've talked to Chris Lewinsky and have gone through the protocol with Boston University. And I've had at least 6 or 7 documented concussions, if not more, from my football and wrestling days. And the one time that I actually got on to into thinking about doing this more, did a wrestling interview or a podcasting with Van Damme. And he had Sabu, Chris Lewinsky, myself, and I think Sandman were on there. We were talking about concussions. And Chris asked, you know, do we all have one question we want to ask him? And I said, you know, about what could be a sign of CTE or you know, problems with your mind. And I basically have problems with my short-term memory. And this was a few years ago. It's slowly getting worse. If I don't write stuff down, put on a mirror, on a note thing or whatever, and I like said, I'm 48 years old, and I'm forgetting things, I will walk into a room and not know why I walk into a room. I will go into a refrigerator 2-3 times and not even know what I'm looking in the refrigerator for. You know, I catch myself doing things and not knowing why I'm here or why I'm doing this. And I asked him, short-term memory loss, because that's definitely a precursor sign to a CTE problem. So if I can donate my brain in the future, I have no problem with long-term memories. My short-term memory is just going to be drizzling shits, basically. It's getting rough at times. And it shouldn't be, but it is. And, you know, I've had my nose, like I said, broke. I've had a lot of head trauma. My jaw's been dislocated twice by Booker T's spin kick, or spinaroonie, whatever you want to call it. I've had my nose broken twice out of 3 times from broken by Van Damme, once by a kick and once by a Van Terminator with a chair in the face. So, I mean, I've had a lot of blows to the head over the years. And so, you know, if I can do something that when I pass in the next decade, however long it is, and they're doing all this testing that can actually help save somebody else down the line, and more power to it.
Amen, brother. Amen. And I think it's great we're seeing more from football now trying to protect the head, you know, different helmets. And if you have a concussion, you're out for the game, and there's going to be more testing, and I think that's great. And,
I do remember what concussion. And the reason I can remember it is because it's the one that really stuck in my mind that it almost caused me to lose my job in WCW. Got a funny little story to it where I was wrestling Perry Saturn, and we were in Pensacola, Florida. And he threw me into toward the steps, and my shoulder hit it, made a big thunk sound, the little steps went right, you know, went boom, took a big bump. And so he picked me up, and I said, the other steps. So he goes, throw me into the other steps. And instead of throwing me in the same way, he threw me in kind of crooked, and the left side of my head hit the steps. And I was in Gaga land. I mean, I don't remember nothing else. I still don't remember the other part of the match. But I remember watching the match after it was taped, and I watched it. You could see my face. I didn't miss a beat in the match. I didn't miss a step for what had gone on, but you could tell my face. I had no clue what was going on. I don't know how I did it. It was just instinct or what, but somehow I didn't miss a beat. But I do remember going in the back, and I was in just Gaga Land. I was a sick boy at the time, and I had stuck my head in the, they said this big thing of sodas and water, big ice bin. I stuck my head in the ice bin and flipped my hair back. And when I flipped my hair back, everything behind me got drenched. And Bischoff, I soaked him. He turned around and said something to me, and I just dropped a bunch of F-bombs on him and shot a bird and told me, you know, told me to kiss my ass and all this stuff. I just went off on him. And he was pretty much was about to fire me until Chuck Taché, who was our trainer guy, sports medicine guy, grabbed me and grabbed Eric and said, no, Eric, you got a concussion. He has no idea what he's doing right now. And the only reason I know this stuff is I can fully picture it in my mind. But I was told it over and over and over again by so many people that were there that it's now ingrained in my mind. And I remember me and Sick Boy went out at Outback Steakhouse after the show, and I cried. I think when I ordered my meal, I was crying. I started laughing when the salad came. I was pissed off when the main meal came, and when dessert came, I think I was crying again or something. And that's too with like the left side of your brain, just with your emotions. So I had put a big bruise on my emotional side of my brain. And so basically everything was misfiring. So my emotions were on a roller coaster. And so for like 2-3 days, I was up, down, all over the place with my emotions. And it was just because I had a concussion. And that was back, I think, in like 97, late, early 98. And the only reason I still remember right now is because I just remember every time I've talked to Chip about it, he's almost always brought it up to me. Do you remember when this happened? And I'm like, not really. And then he told me about it. And slowly the story's gotten into my mind that I remember it now. But my long-term memory is fine. My short-term memory sucks. Like, if I would have forgotten about the interview I had with you if I hadn't had put it down and put the sticky note on my mirror to look at when I woke up this morning. Otherwise, I would
forget about it. Well, I appreciate you did that because yeah. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And I told you I'd call you.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you remembered this interview. I really enjoyed it. And as we wrap up, what's coming up with Scotty Riggs? Any appearances? And
right now, I'm working on a few appearances that may be during the WrestleMania weekend. Maybe with the Mid-South Convention that's going on and a couple other things that are coming in the line towards the summer. Nothing concrete yet. We got a few things in the works. So just basically keep hold of my Twitter, Real Scotty Riggs, or okay. My Facebook, Scotty Riggs, for what's coming up on it. And don't really have anything concrete at the moment. Just got things that are in the works over the next few weeks, so hopefully get some answers to it.
We'll definitely, pass it my way. We'll definitely get the word out for you. And I'm really glad we got a chance to talk. I've always been a fan of your work. I was a big fan of The Flock, you know, back in the WCW days. So this is great for me to, you know, relive a lot of those memories and get an inside perspective of what was going on. So it's been a joy to talk to you, and I'd love to do it again sometime.
Cool, man. I appreciate it. Hopefully I didn't gap too much for you. One of the things that Chris Jericho always said is he called them Rig stories, and he'll be the first to tell you that he'll ask me what time it is. I'll tell him how to go to watch, and still never will tell him what time it is. That's what a Rig story is. I'll tell you everything from A to Y, and then to the end of the story, because I just have so much detail I can give you, but then I never finish the story. And he called them Rig stories, so you just tell them all the time.